guess the moment I decided to write the book was in 2008 when I was sitting in the memorial service for Tim Russert, who was this giant of a newsman who died in the
prime
of
Meet
life,
the Press.
Host of Meet the Press, the longest running television show in history. And I was at his memorial service at the Kennedy Center, and all of the tribes were there, the Democrats, the Republicans, the lobbyists, the media people, the Clintons, the Obamas, the McCains, the Bushes. And I was just struck by how everyone was treating the event like a cocktail party. Everyone was angling for the next interview or giving out business cards or trying to angle for the next job.
And Working the room,
doing a classic Washington thing. But this was memorial service. And I remember at that moment thinking, this was a time that I wanted to step back and sort of chart what this culture has become. And Washington has always been a place for opportunists. It's been a place for opportunity. It's been a place for people working it. But I thought that this had reached a tipping point of self-celebration, and there was this great disconnect between what we were seeing in the Capitol and what we were seeing elsewhere.
I think outside of Washington and Montana and elsewhere in the country, we think it's a town of stark differences. Mm-hmm. But your book points out that it's really people are all too similar. They're part of what you call the
right.
club.
Very, very much so. I think the distinction I would draw is not so much between liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, but really people who are in the club, insiders, and people who are outside, people who are everywhere else. And what you see in Washington is this permanent feudal class. That's a term that a very conservative Republican, Tom Coburn, coined. And that refers to this culture of self-perpetuation, where staying in the job or building your portfolio in the job or getting the next lobbying job after you're voted off out of office becomes the defining imperative of your existence there. And it becomes sort of a self-service game as opposed to a public service game. And not game. I mean, it is sort of what defines you after a while. And look, I mean, there is any number of data points in the book and elsewhere to indicate that people just want to stay on the inside. That's more important than serving their country.
Mm-hmm. You call it branding and the importance of branding yourself.
Branding yourself. No, I mean, I think I ran across a statistic that's in the book, but people really have seized on it, which is that 50% of all U.S. senators, once they're voted out of office, go on to become lobbyists now. That figure compares to 3% in 1974. That indicates to me that this is a professional class of politicians. These are people who want to stay in the game. I mean, George Washington stayed his terms in office and he returned to his farm. I mean, the founders envisioned a system where people would serve their time and then return and immerse themselves in the community. And that's just not the case anymore. There's this sense that if you're elected to office, if you get to Washington, you've punched this lottery ticket that will enable you to cash in on that title or that former title forever.
You also talk about how there's really no such thing as failure, that there's always a second act, and you call it failing upward.
Yes. No, I mean, it's true. I mean, there's really no fall from grace anymore. I mean, even if you look at even the most perverse cases like Anthony Weiner at this point, or Elliot Spitzer, I mean, they're going to be fine. I mean, they'll get great consulting jobs. The unemployment line in politics is very, very short. And there are a lot of people who I characterize in this book as people who had fairly middling runs in office or in their jobs and who have been cashing in on their former status for a long time. I mean, Robert Gibbs, who was the White House press secretary for the first 2 years of the Obama administration, has made about $2 million in paid speeches alone since he left the White House, which is fine. I mean, it's his right to earn a living, but it gets to a level of money in the political system and the celebrity emphasis that's really, I think, transformed this system.
For me, some of the more alarming parts of the book have to do with journalism and the cozy relationship between newsmakers and journalists in D.C.
Right.
Andrea Mitchell is one of the examples you use. She's, of course, married to Alan Greenspan and
right.
hardworking journalist, but
yes. Well, I mean, look. I mean, Andrea Mitchell is a terrific journalist, but it's you do realize that everyone is the social, personal, and professional habitats that people operate in overlap considerably. And another reason I decided to write this town was as an inhabitant of this town, you see the same people cross-pollinating in every single venue over and over and over again. And what happens is, I mean, there's this thing called the green room, which if you've ever been on a television show or any kind of – it's a waiting room essentially on a TV show. And you have these people who are yelling at each other on television going into the green room before and after and essentially sometimes striking business deals, striking these partnerships. I mean, I think a great example of is Terry McAuliffe, who's a longtime Democratic fundraiser and former head of the Democratic National Committee.
Running
for governor of Virginia. Probably going to win. And Ed Gillespie, who is his counterpart in the Republican National Committee, they would argue with each other all the time, and then they would sort of become friends in the green room, and then they decided to take their dog and pony show on the road, and they were getting $50,000 to debate, you know, before live audiences like it's some kind of professional wrestling match. And again, that's sort of part of the system now too.
You say, quote, punditry has replaced journalism as the highest calling.
It has, in my profession at least. I mean, I came into the business, and I think a lot of my colleagues came into the business just with a – if not a passion for anonymity, certainly we were taught that, look, reporting is what we do. We are not supposed to be the story. And what you've seen in the last few decades is a premium placed on who can yell the loudest, who can get on TV, who can be a celebrity. And that's what's going to get you paid, and that's what's going to get you noticed. And that's another, I think, unfortunate fact of what we have now. This book also runs through this explosion in new media where anyone with a Twitter feed or a Facebook page can actually build their own brand and just sort of become famous in this electronic space that has nothing to do with serving your community or even just hands-on journalism.
Or facts, for that matter.
Well, there's that too. Yeah, let's not overlook facts.
You talk about, I think it's a snowflake news.
No, snowflake news is what I call just the phenomena of news that is just like a snowflake, dazzling, and you sort of watch it and it transfixes people for a few seconds, and then all of a sudden it just dissolves into nothing when it hits the ground. And we have now in Washington this echo chamber where people just become fixated on the news of the day, whatever is in Politico, which is this new political sort of website that sort of fancies itself like an ESPN for politics. And these echo chamber vehicles, which because of the new technology, it just happens so fast. And it's just forgotten so fast. And I think it has definitely come at the expense of depth, memory, context, and again, the things that we were taught as journalists a long time ago to value.
You profile in the book, and you have profiled him in the magazine as well, in the New York Times Magazine, Mike Allen, who writes for Politico. Mike Allen outside of D.C. in Montana, for example, is unknown.
That's true. He is,
and he's one of the most powerful
people
in the world.
He is, I argue, the most influential journalist in Washington. I mean, Mike Allen writes this very influential daily email to about 100,000 influencers, he calls them. These are people who are mainly on the coasts, Washington and New York especially. A lot of them book television shows. A lot of them are editors in the newspaper. A lot of them are other reporters. And basically Mike picks and chooses what he thinks is important to emphasize.
And it becomes that.
And you can just see what's in the email newsletter. And I just read it myself. It came in this morning when I woke up. Defines quite a bit of what's on TV that day and so forth. And Mike is this very quirky character. He's very nocturnal. He doesn't sleep. He's extremely private. And I profile him in the book, but he is ultimately an extremely powerful, but yes, very unknown force outside of his realm.
The context of the shutdown in your book is you could not have planned this in terms of
great
book playing
promotion.
Out. No kidding.
Yeah, all things being equal, I would like the government to start. But if it costs me a few sales here, I think I'm willing to serve my country in that way if it gets the government back together again. But no, I mean, look, and I think the underlying premise of this book, and look, people outside of Washington have been both, I think, entertained and appalled by what's been in this book. And that's great. I think that's an appropriate reaction. I think entertaining, fun, I think that's good. But
this
is a very serious and many have said, and I think rightly, appalling picture that I draw. And again, self-service, right? I mean, if you think about what's driving this government shutdown now, you think of a system that now rewards appealing to the extremes, getting attention, getting media attention. Who's the single most, arguably the single most force, other than maybe the president and the speaker in Washington right now is Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz was elected to the Senate less than a year ago. Okay, Ted Cruz doesn't care that he's in no danger of being voted out. He actually doesn't care. He cares about probably running for president in Iowa in 2.5 years. And that constituency loves him, the Tea Party that is going to drive the Iowa caucuses more than anything. He does not care that his Republican colleagues despise him. He does not care about having accomplished anything collaboratively in the Senate, which theoretically is what people used to value not that long ago and you would hope most public servants value. But because of this system and the reward system that we've put in place, Ted Cruz is a phenomenon, and there's probably no one more powerful in the Senate right now than him. And again, I mean, I think we've put in place a system where we're getting attention and non-collaboration and non-cooperation has become the premium because it fits in with the whole food fight mentality that animates this book, but also animates Washington in a big way today.
The book is called This Town, and I have been speaking with the author, Mark Leibovich, who's also the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. I highly recommend the book for people who want to get even more insight into how our capital is functioning or not functioning these days. Mark, thank you so much. Great fun.
Thanks, Sally. I appreciate it.